Arsenal for Democracy is available twice a week. There's a free episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple or Stitcher each weekend, and a midweek bonus episode at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, available for $5 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stunt Bird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 350, recorded on Sunday, February 14th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And first-time guest on the show, longtime friend of the show, John Levitt, calling in from New York City. Welcome to the program, John.
Howdy. Happy to be here.
So, John, we have you on this Valentine's Day episode to talk about back in the era before all the celebs and politicians would say trite things like love is love, a much darker era of American history, the Lavender Scare, which is something that you know a great deal about, and you've read an interesting book that you wanted to talk about with us. So the Lavender Scare, for people who don't know, just sort of the basics, is that this was kind of in parallel to, in conjunction with, and sometimes differentiated from the second Red Scare that was happening around the same time. But instead of focusing on communists, this particular aspect was focused on gay people in the U.S. government, et cetera, and the military and so forth. So, John, could you give us a little more context about what the Lavender Scare was, when it happened, and also the sources that you'll be using today? Of course, as always, we'll have our list of links and so forth up at the arsenalfordemocracy.com post with this episode.
Yeah, so the Lavender Scare, or the sort of top-down prosecution of homosexuals working in the U.S. government and its contractors, started in almost by accident in 1946, which is one of the wilder aspects of this, because it was an offhand comment at McCarthy's famous I Have 91 Names speech. And it kind of snowballed out from there into this larger moral panic about post-war America. And it really has a lot of things in common with the satanic panic and even some current stuff with QAnon, about how people just suddenly became obsessed with this shadowy figure of the homosexual who, unlike, say, communists who were being like brought out, well, not communists, it was mostly people who were like slightly to the left, and that's another article, another thing, is that they never got to speak publicly because no one would go on record as saying, I am a homosexual and I am being persecuted by the U.S. government, until the 60s with Frank Kenemy. And I think like that story, the activism, is much more known because it fits into our narrative of 1960s and 1970s civil rights struggle. But the stuff that came sort of 20 years before that has been completely buried because they used the communism that homosexuals were blackmailable by communists as like the fig leaf for getting rid of them. And now we just remember the fig leaf and we don't remember why we had to invent a fig leaf.
That was sort of an interesting point as we were going over this ahead of time, is that this really was sort of, there was a lot of pretext involved here. There had been this kind of era that's also, I think, not really well remembered, where it was a little bit more acceptable for people to be gay in the government, maybe not openly in the way that we would understand it today, but there was like sort of a relaxation phase and then this sort of crackdown, which was partly a pretext to get rid of gay people, but also getting rid of gay people was a pretext for getting rid of other people that they wanted to get rid of as well.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of irony of the Red Scare is that there weren't that many communist spies in the U.S. government or in America in general, so that it kept having to expand to include new people. And it basically just meant anyone the government at any point didn't like. Like Hazel Scott one of the first black women to host her own television show, has been basically erased from history because she had to flee the country because of how many times she was brought up on House of an American Activity charges because she was trying to, like, desegregate a TV studio.
Not that extreme, certainly, by today's, you know, hindsight on that. You alluded to just a moment ago this issue of people being not even communist, but just vaguely left, and that, you know, could sort of be lumped together in some ways by the people, you know, doing these persecutions with, you know, whether or not somebody was gay. You know, yes, you know, as you just said, some of this starts in 1946, which is still in the Truman years. But a lot of this really is, like, the most intense period is in the early Eisenhower years. And that's not an accident. That was a very deliberate strategy. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that sort of political dimension to it in terms of cleaning house after this long Democratic tenure in the White House.
Oh, yeah. It cannot be separated from the fact that the Republicans were 18 years out of power when this started. And when the first name of list, the list of names McCarthy had in the hearing, some senators said, like, well, these are security risks. What kind of security risks? And he says, well, you know, like drunkards, communists, homosexuals, sexual deviants. And they really hit on that. Like, it was dangled in front of them. Like a thing, and the public went nuts for it. And what was supposed to be this, like, weird internal Senate discussion kept growing into this moral panic, which once the Eisenhower came into office, used as a way to consolidate Republican power by saying, we're going to clean house and we're going to take something that was like this argument about security risks in higher levels of U.S. government got turned into you need to snitch on your co-workers.
That itself became kind of a security problem as well, right?
Well, yeah. And the irony being that they kept bringing up blackmail, and I want to go into, like, their justifications for it, saying that a homosexual is a man who keeps a secret. They rarely ever factored women into this, by the way, including one hilarious bit where a guy in charge of the committee to investigate whether or not homosexuals were a security risk did not know what a lesbian was.
Oops.
Yeah. So they kept saying, like, homosexuals are a security risk because they can be blackmailed. Not only did they never find any case of that happening, but in the course of trying to keep tabs on who working for the government was gay, they ended up with, like, these master lists of 6,000 names and where they were going and what they were doing and who's blackmailing who now.
Well, at that point, you know, not only could that list be stolen, but yeah, they're effectively controlling their own people's lives. And like you said, if everyone's a snitch, that's not exactly a great working environment either in terms of national security.
Yeah, and it goes into, and the book I'm really pulling from is The Lavender Scare by David K. Johnson, which is just, it's really great because after 2000, a lot of these internal government documents got unsealed and he was able to compile most of them. So it's really just stringing together official reports. And there's one bit near the end in the Eisenhower administration where the wife of a diplomat has an official complaint that she can't wait to leave D.C. because no one talks to anyone who isn't of their security grade, and nobody talks on the bus, and you can't even know your neighbor's names because everyone is terrified of being thought of as a spy, which turns people into acting like spies.
Right. What had the environment been during World War II, though, before this sort of post-war purge gets underway?
Much more convenial. Let me put it this way. World War II, as we know it, created the modern, what we think of as a gay lifestyle, gay bars, urban living, largely, like, working in kind of groups, and the public image of the homosexual was basically created by World War II. And there was a much more tolerant atmosphere. There were known bars, there were known cruising areas. There's an entire chapter in this book called This Used to Be a Very Gay Town, and how when it came to unmarried same-sex couples living together, Washington was number two in 1952, just behind San Francisco. So there were a lot of people, a lot of homosexuals working in the U.S. government fairly openly at the time. And actually, that points to something that I wanted to get to, which is that we sort of believe it's like, well, this wasn't really taught in history classes because they were going after communists and the homosexual scare was just kind of a sideline to it. And people didn't really know about it because it wasn't talked publicly. And what the Lavender Scare book does really well is pull out all these examples of pop culture, especially in the early 50s, right around when the Kinsey report came out, that there was this huge mass panic. And like there were jokes about it on the Benny Hill show. There was a popular joke book where one of the jokes was a toddler asks his mother to tell him a fairy story. So she says, well, once upon a time in the State Department.
What was the broader cultural impact of this, though? Because, you know, presumably, as you said, the sort of concept of gay culture emerges during World War II, but then there's this sort of state backlash in the beginning in the 1940s, but then intensifying in the early mid-1950s. What is the broader sort of cultural impact? Was the, you know, I guess to use that phrase that we've all come to know and hate from the last few years with Bannon and folks, is the question is culture downstream from politics or is politics downstream from culture? Which, you know, I don't know what the effect, the cause and effect here was, but I'm assuming there was a broader sort of cultural thing, as you've alluded to, going on in terms of moral panics and things like that.
Well, it became very difficult for people to just congregate. Male employees of the State Department were afraid of being seen eating lunch together. Bars closed rapidly. There was a huge, especially DC police task force called like the Anti-Perversion Brigade, which basically just invaded parks and bathrooms and you know, even restaurants in some cases. It was a microcosm of like what was going on in the Eisenhower security state broader across the world was now just happening within the confines of DC. Just to reorient it, I just want to read from the first chapter of this because it really sets the stage. In February 1950, two statements by U.S. government officials concerning security risks in the State Department captured national attention. One has come to be seen as a pivotal moment in American history, the Wheeling, West Virginia speech that catapulted Senator Joseph McCarthy, R. Wisconsin, into the national limelight and gave the era its name. In that speech, McCarthy made the inflammatory claim that 205 card-carrying communists were working for the State Department. The other statement, although in part a response to McCarthy's continuing charges about subversion in the State Department, has all been lost. Appearing before a congressional committee, Deputy Undersecretary John Fury denied that the department employed any actual communists. At the same time, however, he revealed a number of persons considered to be security risks that had been forced out, and that among them were 91 homosexuals. Rather than see the revelation as an existence of an effective security system, many interpreted it as proof that the State Department and perhaps the entire government was infiltrated with sexual perverts. Goes on. By November, with one journalist described as the panic on the Potomac and some politicians defended as the purge of the perverts, resulted in the dismissal of nearly 600 federal civil servants. In the State Department alone, 70 officials boasted that on average they were firing one homosexual a day, more than double the rate for those suspected of treason or disloyalty.
So that gets to a point that I know you wanted to emphasize here, which was that this wasn't a sideshow. This wasn't a little thing that was happening occasionally. This was an enormous purge in terms of its scale.
Yeah, and it was occurring. Yeah, it occurred for well over a decade. There are people interviewed in here that say basically every year the state's the Senate Appropriations Committee would basically demand that they have a list of homosexuals fired, and they called it a ritual sacrifice. And, you know, this would go on to, like, you have a firing for subversion on your record. You can't really get a job anywhere else. And a really grim later part of the book, when this purge started to trickle down, first from concerning people with high-level clearance down to the secretaries and clerks, because, again, the overwhelming number of people fired were people who had no recourse. They were usually lower-level people, is that a lot of people committed suicide as a result of this because they thought they would never be able to get a job again and they would be tainted by this forever. And there's, like, the one thing that probably ended up – I shared it with you, Bill – the story of how Senator's son got caught up in this and he ended up committing suicide, which is probably like the thing that killed McCarthy's career more than anything else.
Yeah, so this was the story of Senator Lester Hunt from the Mountain West. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more about what happened with him and his son.
Well, Holt was one of McCarthy's like prime backers, I believe, with these continuing purges. And he was caught in one of these anti-perversion raids in Lafayette Park. Whether or not he was there for an illicit encounter was never known, but it made huge, it became huge in the press. And when he was asked to like condemn his son, he sort of didn't, but then he shot himself in his office, and it really put a pall on it, because the thing that comes up a lot is that one of the arguments they used for why they had to purge homosexuals from the intelligence and the State Department was that simply accusing a man of being a homosexual would be enough to blackmail him, whether or not it was true. So it wasn't believed that, oh, Senator Hunt's son must be a homosexual, and that's why he was in the park. It was that he was unfairly accused of it, and that stigma was so great, he had to commit suicide.
And that suicide by Senator Hunt, which, you know, took everyone by surprise, including, I guess, the like last people he'd even talked to, that really kind of slows the momentum of McCarthy and turns the tide of opinion against this. And you, I was wondering, you know, and we'll probably never know, but maybe these McCarthy witch hunts would have gone on much longer had that not happened.
I'm not really sure you can know. It definitely cooled the public opinion because, again, the cultural response to the revelation that there may be homosexuals working for the U.S. government drove the country a little insane, especially since there had been this period of like opening and relaxation of this. You know, immediately post-war, there was a huge boom in what were called lighter than loafer books by the New York Times, which is like The Gallery by and The City and the Pillar. There was much more like accept. Growing to admit that this exists in society and it can be talked about like rationally by adults. And then the Kinsey report came out and had the exact opposite effect Kinsey wanted, which is that instead of people going, oh, there's this broad range of human sexual activity and actually this is quite common, the mainstream American response was, oh no, these people could be anywhere and they look just like us.
Right. Everyone is a little bit gay, therefore everyone is a suspect.
Yeah, and it was interesting in the reports from the courts is that each side would use the Kinsey report to its own advantage. Like the people who were anti-persecution would say, look, this is like a statistical happenstance. It occurs in all human populations. It really doesn't hurt anyone. Why do you care? And the other side would say, look, this proves that they're everywhere and we have to be take care of it.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, I wanted to go to you now and get your thoughts on this and some of your reaction to it as well.
Well, the one thing that really strikes me, like what you alluded to earlier, is that it really did target men more than women. Like you said, they didn't even know what a lesbian was. So I guess what was the gender divide in the State Department? I'm assuming during World War II, by necessity, more women were hired into the State Department. So was there kind of a tightening at the same time? I know a lot of women lost their jobs after World War II, but did they just, I guess, use different excuses to get rid of the women in the State Department because they weren't specifically calling them out for like homosexuality?
Yes and no. The thing is, if you read like op-eds at the time and, you know, people who were considered Pulitzer Prize winning, top selling newspaper columnists were saying things like, well, you know, we have to get rid of the commies in the State Department because they want to pay women the same as men. And that means they'll start families later. And that means our birth rates will drop and the Soviets will win.
There was
this idea that like anything approaching gender equality was a secret commie plot to sap our men's vital fluids. And again, they're very blunt about this. They're like, men, do you want your son to become a manager or a typist? Because, you know, clerical work was heavily coded female. And there was also this element that the State Department had gotten too big under Roosevelt, and this New Deal bloat of what they called do-gooder intellectuals, which sounds an awful lot like political, the way they use it is like politically correct or know-it-alls. like who want to come in and measure your window blinds and make sure you're doing everything correct. And Americans won't stand for that. So we have to like fire all these people we hired during the war in order to shrink the government back down to a reasonable level. And one way you do that is you accuse everyone who works at the State Department of being a secret commie queer who's coming after your kids.
Right. I mean, that seems like the element that you were talking about earlier with the so-called ritual sacrifice every year to the Senate Appropriations Committee. That's not just about purging New Dealers in terms of their ideology. It's also about shrinking the size of government because the size of the government, the growth of the government is directly associated with the New Deal era, with the World War II era, two decades of uninterrupted democratic control of the executive branch.
You know, the irony, of course, being is why while this is going on, while we have to like absolutely defund the government because it's a moral issue, the security and surveillance state is growing larger and larger and larger in order to surveil the people who they want to fire and shrink.
Yeah, that's what kind of jumped out at me is the fact that it kind of started out as like a security risk, but then it really trickled down to people that would be handling like secret material at all. So that really makes sense, that aspect that they're just trying to shrink the State Department by any means necessary. And this was just kind of a convenient excuse to do so.
Yeah, no. In 1952, the Procedures Manual for Security Officers contained a 9-page section devoted to homosexuality, the only type of security offense singled out for such coverage. If you were a Communist Party of America member, you got less scrutiny than if you were a suspected homosexual. And this is also true of people who were like members of former fascist groups.
Well, I suppose that's not a huge surprise, right?
Yeah, well, you know, they get the first class plane ticket back.
Right. Now, you had referred to this earlier in passing, but this sense that, you know, that initially, the view was that these people could be blackmailed by, you know, the Soviets into doing the bidding of the, you know, global communist menace or whatever, and this was going to undermine American security state. But this sort of ballooned a little bit into, you know, by the time this was happening in the early to mid 1950s, this sense that, and this gets back to that wider sort of cultural impact, that it wasn't just about security risk as much as like an existential threat to all of American society. One of the quotes that you provided from Arthur Guy Matthews in 1953 was, quote, "Homosexuality is Stalin's atom bomb to destroy America," which, I mean, talk about over the top. But that was, you know, there were people who, you know, believed that. And I guess that's for the same reason that, you know, Victorian moralists maybe also got upset about gay people, which is that this was going to, you know, have some sort of deleterious effect on the population growth, the economy, natalist policies, the family, etc., right?
Oh, yeah. And it was all tied up into one big thing. It was like every fear an American could possibly have became part and parcel of this lavender scale. It was that, well, gay people are only loyal to other gay people, so they formed this like worldwide Freemasonry. Or that this was like a result of the New Deal. There's a person quoted in Arthur Guy Matthews' book saying he was an Iowa farmer who said, "The homosexual scandals took me by surprise. Such thing did not exist when I was a boy. I can tell you exactly when this moral degradation of America began. It started with the election of Franklin Roosevelt."
Again, very convenient to the overall ideological project of trying to roll that entire thing back.
Jack Layden Lee Mortimer, who wrote a very influential book at the time called Washington Confidential, which basically confirmed every like John Birch Society paranoid fear about Washington, D.C. was actually true. They also, by the way, thought that the UN was a secret homosexual conspiracy. But they say that suggesting that Washington, D.C. was a garden of pansies, the book read, "If you're wondering where your semi-boy is tonight, he's probably in Washington." In the following year's expose, Late and Mortimer increased that figure to include 10,000 known homosexuals working for the state government. Arthur Guy Matthews, in his book entitled Homosexuality, a Menace, similarly exaggerated the estimate to 7,000 and dubbed Washington, D.C. a platonic and Socratic homosexual playground. Matthews claimed that having been booted out of the State Department, large numbers of homosexuals were now headed to New York City to descend upon the unsuspecting UN. The language used, especially by these contemporary writers, is the language of, like, it's not just an other, it's what they call them, sexual psychopaths. And it got bigger and bigger as time went on, to the point where one of the key things in the Huey trials, which sort of like codified this as being a thing that the national security state could do, because they switched it over from being a security risk to a loyalty risk, which is like a lot harder to define. And mm-hmm. so it's more broadly applicable, which is that no sane, normal man would associate with a homosexual. So if they're associating with them, that must mean there's something wrong with them. And that means they're also suspect. And the other big one was, and this was related to the whole false accusation thing, is that one of the things about the Huey trials is that the other side tried to get a lot of like respected medical professionals on their side to say, like, no, prosecuting homosexuals doesn't make any sense. In fact, there was one famous one where the guy said, look, if you prosecute these people, they're going to become radicals because you're going to isolate them from society. And he was kind of right.
Well, and that's how we got gay ISIS.
Yeah. And so, like, one of the lawyers brought up, and they said, like, well, you know, like, what if someone is accused of homosexuality by a communist agent who happens to be like a police officer or something, right? And like that could be the cause of blackmail, because like they tried to find an instance of an American being blackmailed over their sexuality, and they couldn't. They had to go to like pre-World War I Austria to find a case, and it was by like this real Operation Paperclip German guy who was advising the team. But that wasn't even over sexuality. It was over the fact that the guy who was being blackmailed was like defrauding the state of tens of thousands of crowns or something. So they settled on the fact that like someone could be falsely accused and that could be used as blackmail. And then they got that out in the press saying, have you been falsely accused of homosexuality? And they used the tons of reports generated to prove that it existed.
Yeah, something that jumped out at me is like all these newspaper articles and books at the time were throwing out all these numbers. Was there actually an effort to find out the true numbers of gay people in Washington at the time?
No, we only really have the numbers of – we only have like self-reported diaries of people at the time to get an idea of how large their social scene was. But really, we can only go by the number of people who were let go without cause or let go because of suspected subversion. But we do know enough to know that the majority of those numbers were probably, yeah, suspected homosexuality or, you know, being friends with someone who was suspected of homosexuality. Because again, by the end, you know, by the 60s, the DC police had books and books and books and books of surveillance on people just because they happened to be friends with someone else.
We have no way of knowing if they were, you know, just genuinely friends with them or if they were themselves actually gay.
Or if they were like, yeah, even passing associates, at a certain point, the thing that jumped out at me is like when they were trying to hire new people for new departments, they had to go through this like laborious testing process of like cross-referencing them with all of their lists of known homosexuals and their aliases. That was like 6,000 names long. So yeah, it was like choking the State Department with red tape.
Yeah. I mean, people forget how intense some of that's isolation process was for anybody that was in any sort of clearance related job. I mean, that happened in my family as well, that, you know, certain members of the family were just completely cut off from other members of the family for decades because, you know, oh, so-and-so is a communist involved with the Longshore Union or whatever. And, you know, I have a infrastructure related job or telecommunications job, something that has some sort of clearance and or at least some is considered to be a potential security risk. And, you know, it would break up families because you couldn't talk to your, you know, brother or your kid or, you know, your in-laws or whatever, because there was some alleged or real in the case of my family, you know, communist affiliations, militant trade union affiliations, things like that. And this was, you know, they just for years and years, you just say, no, you have to completely sever all contact with anybody that could even potentially be on one of these lists, whether it was communist or perversions or whatever.
Yeah, and it, you know, it destroyed people professionally, and particularly people who are like trying to get stable government jobs were suddenly finding themselves digging ditches. Or, you know, part of the reason the growth of the gay bar came is there were a lot of people who couldn't work anywhere else.
And as you said, this also led to a lot of suicides because people were desperate. You know, they had trained for a career in government that was going to last them their whole lifetimes. And all of a sudden they couldn't get a job anywhere because they had been blacklisted as part of the Lavender Scare.
Right. Let me see if I can find. I have notes on every other page of this book because there are just so many eye-popping examples of just like the official words people would use, like, in courthouses to describe other people are just amazing. Dr. Carl M. Bowman, its former president of the American Medical Association, deplored the wave of hysteria in Washington regarding homosexuality, where the person suspected of homosexuality is banned from government work, warning that if the present program is continued, gay men and lesbians might find it impossible to earn a living. And then there was the hatchet man in the State Department under Eisenhower, who like created his own special division for rooting out homosexuals, Miscellaneous M Division. And that's all they did. And he even writes in his own memoirs, like, well, the only thing I really felt bad about doing is that a lot of people after they came to my office to be fired would shoot themselves. And he's very blasé about it.
One question that I had was about some of the people who were doing this. Now, some of them were just straight up and down nasty people and they weren't themselves gay, but there was some of the people involved in these purges either were suspected of or were in fact gay themselves, including one of McCarthy's associates, I believe, right?
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, McCarthy, for the final stretch of the Huey Commission, hired Roy Cohn. So that's another thread.
Well, sure, you can talk about that. I don't know if our listeners would necessarily be familiar with, you know, much beyond sort of maybe a photograph or something.
Well, you know, like Roy Cohn, the infamous New York mob boss, right-hand man of J. Edgar Hoover, guy who tutored Trump in dealing with modern life. A real like evil Forrest Gump. He just shows up whenever the U.S. government is doing something awful.
And he himself was he definitely gay or just suspected that he was gay?
What we'll probably never know, but according to like contemporary reports and people who know him, yeah. Basically, the couple accounts of this time period like do heavily suggest that there were a number of closeted individuals who were using the Lavender Scale as a smokescreen for their own actions. It is, you know, we don't know, like to make that argument anymore because especially nowadays it comes off as very crass. But, you know, in a period where people were much more heavily closeted, particularly if they had any kind of power, does raise an eyebrow. The Lavender Scale actually got a big boost because of the Summer Wells scandal, because that was a case of not of a like high-ranking homosexual in the U.S. government. High-ranking homosexual in the U.S. government sounds like a title. Like abusing their security clearance, but he was just like preying on servants. And the work got leaked. Anyway, they used the fact that he was heavily connected with the New Deal government to imply that, well, it's these wealthy East Coast degenerates who want to impose their will on the rest of the United States. And everybody knows he was fired because he was gay, but not like he was fired because he was kind of a sexual predator.
Well, that, I think, gets into a broader sort of cultural point here, which is, and you sent me a link about this as well, by the early 1960s, there was this sort of conflation of like legit, somewhat legitimate, somewhat paranoid sort of stranger danger type worries or fears of predators and things like that, and conflating that with, you know, gay people broadly and not really separating out that, like, yes, predators are bad. Maybe we're over exaggerating the prevalence of predators, and also everyone in this community is a predator, which, of course, again, that's another thing that is not popular to talk about. Now, I saw something about the example that you sent me. There was a teacher that got suspended a few years ago for showing this in the classroom as part of a demonstration of this is what the sort of like regressive attitudes on gay people used to be. And even just showing it in the classroom was considered potentially very unacceptable. I don't know what the outcome was beyond suspension. But, you know, it's like you said, there's a number of these things that it's uncomfortable for us to even talk about it today, because then it sounds like we're doing tropes or whatever, as opposed to just saying, no, this is like what the, you know, these were, there were some, you know, kernel of these things that were actually happening that then gets spun into a broader sort of cultural thing, whether it's saying, you know, it's not, oh, you know, there were gay people who were, you know, persecuting other gay people because they were, you know, self-hating. It's like, no, they were using it to distract attention from themselves. And that wasn't necessarily a widespread thing, but it maybe happened. And then you have cases like what you just mentioned, where there would be some actual predator, and then they would blow that into like, oh, all of these people that are getting purged are also predators. And then that filters out into the broader sort of cultural depiction of gay people by, say, the early 1960s.
Yeah, and the thing I sent you, Boys Beware, do check it out. It's on YouTube. It was a Stranger Danger early 1960s video about like for young boys to watch out for these homosexuals in their long cars, glasses, tiny. It's basically John Waters is after your kid.
He would never do that.
He would never do that, no. But, yeah, and it's, you know, it's hilarious to look at now because ha, ha, ha. But it's like, no, this was taken seriously and people died because of it. And many thousands of people lost their livelihood.
Something that sort of jumps out at me from this and a lot of the other things that you've talked about so far today is this, you know, we all know that the sort of like rose tinted nostalgia, whatever, around the 1950s is like total propaganda, like completely made up. And obviously what often gets brought up is the racial civil rights movement stuff happening at the same time obviously proves that this wasn't some sort of halcyon period. But like looking back at stuff like this, whether it's that 1961 propaganda film or just the sort of snitch culture developing in the government and so forth, it seems like one of the central characteristics of the 1950s that is not remembered as part of the nostalgia is the just sheer level of paranoia around everything. You know, this idea that I have no idea what the level of like, you know, serial killer whatevers was at the time, but like this film basically suggesting that like anybody can get snatched off the street by a stranger at any time. And of course, that doesn't even get into whether or not stranger danger as opposed to somebody that you know, closely know is actually a bigger threat. But like, I don't think we've ever sort of had a cultural rendition of the 1950s other than maybe in some horror movie or something. But like, it's like, oh yeah, you know, everyone was living in this, you know, great idyllic life in the suburbs. And also everyone was getting kidnapped off the streets and murdered constantly. You know, that feels like more of a sort of maybe late 1970s, definitely 1980s, you know, satanic panic type of stuff. And obviously when we were kids, you know, in school, I'm sure that all of us probably had the, you know, stranger danger type of lectures, you know, don't get in a car with someone that you don't know, that kind of thing. That, you know, the latchkey generation certainly gets the sort of paranoia around being snatched off the street or whatever. But clearly this was also a feature of life in the 1950s in the United States as well, at least in the suburban section of the United States, probably more than some of the other places.
Oh yeah, definitely. You know, one problem about like looking backward or our cultural context for the 1950s is that we get a lot of it from our parents, who by and large were children during that time period. So they, when they created media about the 50s, they created media about their childhood, which of course is, you know, very different than if you're an adult. And if you read cultural products from the 1950s written by people who lived through them as adults, you get a very different picture. I mean, the overwhelming tone, especially like in magazines, people would say is it's the age of the crack up. Like we have this booming post-war society and everyone is like drinking themselves to death and screaming.
And, you know, becoming the early suburban pillhead archetype, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. Anesthetize. There was a whole thing about how veterans felt like they couldn't talk about any of their experiences because everyone was just trying to have a nice time and put that behind them now. And we kind of lost that sense of like the suffocating dread, especially while people's mail are being read by the police because they don't like that person's roommate. And you have lines like, columnist George Sokovsky, who is like this highly regarded columnist, talking about Harry Truman, like kind of putting the brakes on this inquiry into suspected homosexuals in the State Department, saying, "Certainly, Harry Truman cannot like either communists or homosexuals, but why does he protect for them? Why does he fight for them?"
Cool.
And, if you read conservative reports of the time, they refer to Truman's fair deal as the fairy deal constantly.
Yikes.
My personal favorite was a religious tract that was very popular. It said, "Communist literature undertakes to justify degenerate acts on the grounds of personal liberty and preference, as opposed to moral obligation and duty."
That also gets into one of the other big themes that I wanted to talk about before we let you go is, we talked about that quote earlier, homosexuality is Stalin's atom bomb to destroy America. But in the Soviet Union, things were not necessarily much better, despite the American propaganda that you just talked about, where, they would say, being a homosexual goes hand in hand with being a communist because, they're, I guess, social libertines or whatever. But that was not necessarily the case. I mean, there was obviously mixed opinions, certainly. But Stalin himself, to go back to that quote, not really a fan of gay people. Could you talk a little bit about the sort of situation in the Soviet Union, considering how much of an emphasis there was on this Cold War link in the United States?
Oh, yeah. And just to rewind slightly, one of the things that kept popping up around discussion about the Kinsey Report is that when it first came out, the overwhelming media line was that this is a dangerous report because it'll prove to the Soviets that we're weak and effeminate. Meanwhile, over in the Soviet Union, Stalin had reinstated all of the previous czarist laws that were struck off the books during the Bolshevik Revolution, concerning sex and sexuality, reinstated them. And there's this really, really heartbreaking letter written in 1934 by Harry White, who was an English communist living in Moscow, called "Can a Homosexual Be a Member of the Communist Party?" And it's very long, and it's really entreating Stalin to realize the error of his ways and that this is a great injustice. And, I've been a proud communist like my entire life. I've moved to Moscow. I'm ready to give my life for this cause. So please don't make us second class citizens. That's not very Marxist of you, Comrade Stalin. And apparently he read it and then just listed it, just labeled it as pervert, idiotic, and filed it away.
I found the letter very fascinating because it's hard to imagine someone at sort of the height of Stalin's power writing him a letter and saying, "Actually, I think if you read the, original Engels, or, actually, if you consult your Marxist literature or whatever, you'll find that there's no incompatibility between being homosexual and being a communist. And this is a matter of importance to potentially several million Soviet citizens, et cetera. Obviously, if there's a political crime, please go ahead and prosecute it. But if it's just a crime of sexual orientation or relationship and there's no other problem with that person, then you need to reconsider your policy." It's amazing that someone felt confident enough to write a letter like that to Stalin.
Well, that was actually not very uncommon. We have large archives when they were opened of letters sent to Stalin from gulags saying, "Listen, I know this was obviously a mistake and you don't have the full information, but I'm not here for the right reasons."
In general, though, when did things ever get relaxed from sort of the height of Stalin's persecutions of gay people in the Soviet Union? Was there ever an era where things were sort of more enlightened than in the United States, not counting the initial sort of revolutionary period?
Not particularly. There was a very good art installation a while back called "Homosexuality is Stalin's Bomb to Destroy America." And it was about like trying to find Soviet gay culture. And they said one of their big findings, it's most notable for its absence because it couldn't leave any records of itself. So we kind of don't know. In fact, it was caused a huge problem when they were trying to battle AIDS in the Soviet Union, is because no one would come forward at all.
Not that the situation was all that much better in the United States as well. I mean, you know, certainly little bit more people willing to come forward eventually, but early on that was a dangerous factor too.
That was a big thing. It was a real case of, and I made this a piece in my Baffler art thing about the history of propaganda, which is like the queers were just getting it from both ends of the First and Second World, because each one was using the other one as a scapegoat. You know, in the Soviet Union, homosexuals were all like decadent bourgeois imperialists who want to, you know, weaken and effeminize the great proletarian man. And in the West, it was homosexuals are all like these effete, psychologically unstable communists, because communism makes you psychologically unstable, because it makes you think this, you know, the way of things isn't right, and they're going to infiltrate and turn all our, you know, make all our women into men and all our men into women. In fact, there's an excellent quote from Walter Winchell about Adlai Stevenson, because Adlai Stevenson, at the time he was running, was the subject to a lot of gay rumors. And again, I need to stress, this was not hushed up. This was not like, oh, did you hear a about? Like, this was stuff reported on and alluded to, like, in major newspapers. There was even a big expose in, I want to say the Washington Post or one of those. And the headline just had to say, so about that Stevenson story. And they never had to address what the story was, that he had in fact had a homosexual affair in college, because everyone knew what it was. And Walter Winchell wrote on the eve, like upcoming the eve of the election, again, a very famous columnist, name checked in the Producers, said, finished his column by saying, a vote for Adlai Stevenson is a vote for Kristine Johansson, the first like publicly known male to female transsexual in the United States.
Yeah, I suppose we didn't really get into that, but presumably the persecutions were, although they were mostly targeted toward gay men, were like targeting other people as well who would be considered today to be within the LGBTQ community, right?
Right. I mean, and you know, there are also like police reports of these investigations saying like, yeah, some of these guys we never would have caught because like they only slipped up once. Otherwise they had like a wife and kids and seemed totally normal. But like more to the point, Winchell saying that like a vote for Adlai Stevenson is a vote for transsexualism is just, it's the culture war. It's mm-hmm. the same thing. Nothing has changed.
Right.
And somewhat ironically, this scrutiny and persecution actually did radicalize the community. It kind of sowed the seeds for what would later become like the gay rights movement. Do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Oh yeah. Frank Kameny was fired from his position in, it was naval map making. Anyway, he worked for the Navy and he was fired, and he thought very unjustly for like not hiding being a gay man in Washington. And he basically started a nonstop letter writing campaign. He helped form the East Coast chapter of the Medicines, which were an early gay rights organization after they purged all their communists. And, you know, he did a very brave thing. And he was one of the major figures that helped kick off gay rights in order to eventually get all of these like rules and riders and executive orders officially off the books by 1976. Not in the military, though. That would take a little while longer. But yeah, it was like the quote from the psychoanalyst before, like if you exclude these people, they're going to eventually fight back.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, a lot of them found themselves with no career prospects. And if they didn't commit suicide, then they were left to, you know, kind of just sit around thinking, well, this is not fair. What can I do about it? And that leads to this sort of wave of activism after the fact, which we remember a little bit better than the actual purge itself.
Yeah, and the PBS documentary about Lavender Scale like really leans heavily into the activism part, which is very worthwhile, but like that's the part that gets taught in school. The part that doesn't get taught in school is the 25 years of like sustained organized prosecution, basically by a Republican Party that was embarrassed that it wasn't in power long enough and used it as like as a foothold to create a moral panic that would bring them into the White House and into power. And the thing about gay men or homosexuals in general organizing in the 60s and finding like more common cause and more community is that it upended the cultural picture of the gay man in the 1950s, which is like a middle-class professional who is very isolated and has no community, which I thought was interesting because it's almost a return to the previous sort of World War II and before era of there being fairly tight-knit homosexual communities where people, especially in urban areas, all knew each other. And you can sort of see the Lavender Scare as this interregnum created by like state oppression of a minority group.
And I'm sure concurrently contributing to that was just the suburbanization trend in general, right? As you're atomizing and alienating the entire American society, it helps sort of reinforce the crackdown and break up these sort of urban gay communities.
Right, right.
Well, John, I think we're going to have to leave it there. As I said earlier, we will have all of the links that you've talked about up at arsenalfordemocracy.com when the episode goes up. Is there anything else that you want us to sort of take away from this that we haven't really emphasized enough yet?
Just that this was an expressly political project, and it was used very cynically by a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't care. There was the guy who didn't know the Hughes Committee, the guy who didn't know what lesbians were. He didn't want to be on that committee, but he was chosen because he was the most sort of like, he ran on a white nationalist ticket. Like, he was one of the most vehemently right-wing senators. But personally, he didn't actually care about it, but it was just a great political wedge because they had spent 18 years out of power and wanted nothing more than to like undo all the New Deal reforms, which, you know, they eventually got to do. And they used, you know, the Red Scare was kind of like for publicity and chilling, but when it came to actually changing how the government works, they used the Lavender Scale.
Where can people find your work and more about you online besides the links that we're going to be putting up?
I am on Twitter, unfortunately, at Levitt Alone, L-E-A-V-I-T-T Alone. Sameword.net is my portfolio site with writing and art. Other than that, yeah, link to my piece in The Baffler about the history of propaganda.
All right, will do. John Levitt, thank you so much for coming on Arsenal for Democracy today to talk about the Lavender Scare with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.